Right, well, we might as well get started. My name is Charles Goodhart, and my role here, and indeed my privilege and pleasure, is to introduce Professor Peter Kennan to you. Peter is Professor of Economics and International Finance at Princeton University. He has been head of the International Finance Section for 28 years, and he is now staying with us for some months, I'm glad, delighted to say, here at LSE. He is, in my view, the most experienced and astute observer of international financial developments from European Monetary Union through the Asia crisis to the subject that he's going to be talking to us about tonight, which is the international financial architecture, what's new and what's missing. My expectation is that the weight of one of those buckets will be considerably greater than the weight in the other of those buckets, but I think we ought to hear that from Professor Kennan.
This is not my first time at the LSE, though it is my first time at this end of the platform in the old theater. I heard Bob Rubin the other night here at the LSE reminiscing about his days as a student here, when he said he was listed by the institution as being an ostensible student, whatever that might mean, and reported that when he returned to the States and told his draft board, because we did have conscription at the time, that he was registered as a student at the London School of Economics, he was asked whether this was a respectable institution. My experience was parallel, if not identical. I was here before the LSE had begun to take a somewhat cynical view of its American student visitors. I was not called an ostensible student. I was called a research student. And I took that seriously, unfortunately. And I actually produced my doctoral dissertation for Harvard while I was here at the LSE. Actually, I returned to the States with a completed dissertation and an incomplete child. My wife was 3 months pregnant when we returned to the States, and I was hoping that that might affect my draft status, though it was not the reason for the pregnancy. I ran into a similar problem, however, when I told my draft board that my wife was pregnant. In those days, pregnancy tests were performed with the aid of a rabbit. And my draft board was not content that a British rabbit was reliable. It insisted that I go back and have an American rabbit confirm that my wife was pregnant, which I duly did. The question posed in the, questions I should say, posed in the title of my lecture, What's New and What's Missing, do suggest two baskets. One will be heavier than the other. They also suggest a framework for my lecture. I will try to list for you and to assess the principal results of recent official efforts to strengthen the international financial system. I will also try to draw attention to issues which have not yet been resolved. That's what's missing. Focusing on two of them. First, the need to devise better carrots and sticks for inducing the emerging market countries to adopt reforms that the architecture exercise has identified as being essential to reduce the risk of future crises. The second, and more controversially, a need to find better ways of involving the private sector in the resolution of international financial crises in the future. Let me start with a rather brief history of the architecture exercise. Some people don't appear to realize that it was not launched in the wake of the Asian crisis of 1997-98, but was rather launched way back in 1995 at the G7 Halifax summit after the Mexican crisis, and thus long before the Asian crisis. Furthermore, it appears, in my view, to have ended, and prematurely, with the Cologne summit in 1999. Why do I say that the exercise is, for all practical purposes, over? Well, first of all, in past years, the G7 finance ministers reported to each year's G7 summit on the progress of the exercise and promised to report again at next year's summit. In their report at the Cologne summit, however, the ministers promised merely to report as necessary. Furthermore, the G7 communique issued at the 1999 IMF World Bank meetings spoke of the plan for reform which had been set forth at the Cologne summit and the need to implement that plan fully. At the same time, Michel Camdessou, the managing director of the fund, declared that work on the architecture exercise has, in his words, entered a new phase with fewer announcements of new initiatives but greater focus on the specification and implementation of existing ones. In other words, the official community appears to believe that the architects have designed the blueprint and it is now for the masons and the carpenters to build the house, whereas I will try and show you this evening that we are far from that. The most we have are, if you wish, architects' drawings, not architects' plans. I must also say that I detect a sharp erosion of political commitment to the architecture exercise in the G7 countries and the emerging market countries as well, with disturbing implications even for the implementation of existing agreements as well as prospects for new initiatives. And to be sure, Larry Summers proposed further reforms of the fund in his speech a few weeks ago at the London Business School, but these, I suspect, would encounter much opposition, not only from the governments of countries that would be adversely affected by those initiatives, but from other G7 governments and in the United States from the U.S. Congress. In fact, Summers' speech in London can perhaps be viewed as an effort to preempt a forthcoming report of a special commission created by the Congress and chaired by Professor Alan Meltzer. And if you want some forecast of that report, let me merely tell you that Professor Meltzer, if he had his choice, would not reform the fund, he would abolish it. So the climate is not exactly favorable to seriously consider reform efforts of the fund. As for the evolution of the architecture exercise, I said that it began after the Mexican crisis of 1994-95, and it is worth recalling three features of that crisis which cast a shadow forward on official thinking. The first, of course, was the fact that it involved a uniquely important country. Mexico was economically and politically important to the United States, a feature reinforced by what was at the time the newness of NAFTA and the divisive domestic debate about it. Mexico, however, was also systemically important, partly because the debt crisis of the 1980s was triggered by a Mexican default in 1982, and the prospect of another Mexican default set up tremors in the minds of many people. Second, Mexico had been the first and most prominent beneficiary of the revival of capital flows, private capital flows, after the debt crisis was resolved in the early 1990s. Two other features of the Mexican crisis also played a role in the Asian crisis which followed. First of all, Mexico had a pegged exchange rate and had promised emphatically to maintain that peg rate with two pernicious consequences. First of all, it fostered what I have called from time to time strategic denial. And this is the effort by governments to maintain or restore investor confidence by pretending that its problems are minor and transitory and that everything will be okay if people will just wait a while. This rarely succeeds in altering investors' behavior, but often deceives the government itself, which then postpones necessary policy changes. Secondly, I'm still speaking of a pegged exchange rate. When forced to abandon the pegged rate, Mexico attempted a small devaluation, but having already run down its reserves to defend the older exchange rate, it could not possibly defend the new one. It had to float the peso and watch it depreciate precipitously. This is an echo of the Italian story of 1992 and a foretaste of the Asian story in 1997. Taiwan was the only Asian country able to move from one pegged rate to another, and that because it moved preemptively, not under speculative pressures, and because it had extensive capital controls. Finally, Mexico had issued a huge quantity of short-term dollar-indexed debt, the so-called tesabonos, in an effort to offset the sharp fall in other capital inflows and to minimize the loss of reserves. When the peso depreciated, after being allowed to float, the fiscal cost in pesos of servicing that dollar index debt rose astronomically, and holders of maturing tesabonos began to wonder whether Mexico would be able to service them and were therefore reluctant to roll over their holdings. Mexico therefore teetered for weeks on the brink of default until the United States and the IMF provided massive financial assistance, enabling Mexico to redeem the tesabonos that it had been unable to roll over. Now, there's a lot more that went on in Mexico, but those are some features that I think we ought to bear in mind as we look ahead at some of the problems that featured in the architecture exercise. At the 1995 Halifax summit itself, the G7 countries made five recommendations reflecting their misgivings about the way the Mexican crisis had been handled, and more generally, their concern about coping with future crises. First, they called upon the IMF to intensify its surveillance of national policies and to send, and I quote, franker messages, unquote, to governments that were slow to make necessary policy changes. Well, the IMF did that in the case of Thailand, but the messages were ignored. Second, the G7 asked the IMF to set standards for the publication by governments of economic and financial data so that markets would be more fully informed about developments in emerging market countries, and to identify publicly those countries which complied with the new data standards. The IMF did that too, and it has since tightened those standards to make governments publish more data on reserves, on reserve-related liabilities, and on external claims and debts of the private sector. Excuse me. Third, the summit asked the IMF to devise ways of accelerating access to IMF credit in crisis situations and to make larger upfront disbursements of IMF credit in those cases. The IMF responded initially by devising new procedures to keep the executive board fully informed of discussions between a crisis-stricken country and the fund's management, and has since gone much further in establishing two additional financial facilities. The Supplementary Reserve Facility, or SRF, to make larger amounts of fund credit available for short periods and at high interest rates, or higher than the standard rates the fund charges. And second, the so-called contingent credit line, which involves earmarking fund credit for countries that are following sound policies but are vulnerable to cross-country contagion. The SRF was used to provide large-scale assistance to Korea in 1997. To my knowledge, however, no country has yet been granted a contingent credit line. And one fund official with whom I spoke shortly before leaving the United States said, we have a Groucho Marx problem. Some of you may remember that Groucho Marx once said that any club, he wouldn't want to join any club that would admit him to membership. Well, that appears to be the problem with the CCL, that those countries which qualify don't want it, and those countries which want it don't qualify. Fourth, the Halifax summit asked the G10 governments and other governments not previously involved to double the size of the credit lines available to the IMF under the general arrangements to borrow. The result, after long negotiations, was the establishment of what we now call the new arrangements to borrow, which involve several additional governments, including a number of emerging market countries. The new arrangements to borrow, the NAB, is now the fund's primary source of short-term credit from member governments when its own resources are too small to meet the demands on them. Finally, the summit asked the G10 industrial countries to review other procedures that might help resolve future crises, In response, the G10 countries convened a working party under the chairmanship of Jean-Jacques Rey of Belgium, so their report is known as the Rey Report, and it issued its report in 1996, a full year before the Asian crisis. The report was endorsed by the G10 governments themselves. Although the report did not explicitly criticize the way that the Mexican crisis had been handled, it clearly was concerned to make sure that future crises would be handled differently. It was a bit of, we were right the first time, but we're not going to do it again. The report said that official funds would not be used to bail out particular groups of investors in the future, as the Tesa Bono holders had been bailed out, in effect, in the case of Mexico. Instead, said the report, future sovereign liquidity crises should be resolved by debt workouts. And let me quote directly. Neither debtor countries nor their creditors should expect to be insulated from adverse financial consequences by the provision of large-scale official financing in the event of a crisis. There should be no presumption that any type of debt will be exempt from payment suspensions or restructurings in the event of a future sovereign liquidity crisis. The report acknowledged that the restructuring of securitized debt, like the Tesa Bonos, for example, would be far more difficult than was the restructuring of bank-held debt in the 1980s, where it was possible to identify and get together, at least in one very large room, the principal creditors. Now we have mutual funds, pension funds, all sorts of institutions holding emerging market country debt, and clearly it's much more difficult to get them together, let alone get them to agree. To this end, the report made two recommendations. First, that new sovereign debt contracts should contain so-called collective action clauses to facilitate the representation of creditors, to permit qualified majority voting on proposals to alter the terms of existing debt contracts in the course of a restructuring, and require that any payment received by one creditor be shared with all other creditors, so as to reduce the incentive for dissident creditors to go out on their own and seek a side deal with the debtor. Second, I should say, by the way, that such clauses commonly appear today in, and have appeared for some years, in Eurobonds, which are issued under UK law, but not those under US law. Second, the IMF should be prepared to lend into arrears, which is to say that it should provide financing before a debtor government has reached agreement with its private creditors. Such lending, it said, can both signal confidence in the debtor country's policies and indicate to unpaid creditors that their interests would be best served by quickly reaching an agreement with the debtor. The report conceded that no single government would want to be the first to add collective action clauses to its debt contracts for fear of raising the cost of borrowing. And it was right about the reluctance of countries to adopt those clauses unilaterally. No country that had not adopted them before has adopted them now. It may have been wrong, oddly enough, about the effect on the cost of borrowing. One recent study concludes that the inclusion of collective action clauses actually lowers the cost of borrowing for highly rated borrowers, raises the cost only for riskier borrowers, although the effects are not numerically very large in either case. But the G7 governments have not used either carrots or sticks to promote the use of these collective action clauses, although they have repeatedly endorsed the use of such clauses. They could include such clauses in their own debt contracts, a carrot, an incentive, but they have declined to do so, although I understand that the UK has recently done so unilaterally. They could require that clauses be attached to new foreign bonds issued in their markets, a stick, but they haven't done that either. However, the IMF has accepted the second recommendation to lend into arrears. In fact, it did that when it approved new funding for Russia, before Russia had reached agreement with its London Club, that is bank creditors, on the restructuring of Soviet-era debt, an agreement which was reached just a few days ago. It is worth noting, in the light of the different conditions of the Asian crisis, moreover, that the Rey Report was concerned mainly with sovereign debt, the Mexican Tesa Bonos and their future counterparts, not with private sector debt of the sort that figured prominently in the Asian crisis, and which poses much harder problems. A government can readily suspend its own debt payments, but it may find it much harder to interrupt private sector debt payments without imposing capital controls, and it's very hard to do that if you don't have the administrative apparatus in place beforehand. And this may help to explain why, when the Asian crisis erupted in 1997, the international community acted as though the Wray Report had never been written, let alone endorsed officially. Instead of insisting that Thailand, for example, suspend the repayment of interbank credits in order to halt the loss of reserves, and the IMF and Asian governments provided large-scale official financing for Thailand, and even larger amounts thereafter for Indonesia and for Korea. In only two instances was an effort made to restructure private sector debt as a way to resolve or mitigate the crisis. On Christmas Eve in 1997, an event which Secretary Rubin referred to in his talk here at the LSE a few days ago, he and some other finance ministers got on the phone and persuaded the banks to enter into a voluntary agreement to roll over their claims on Korea. You can imagine how people felt about being called by the Secretary of the Treasury on Christmas Eve and asked to do him a favor. The ultimate resolution of the Korean interbank debt problem, however, was achieved only with a guarantee on the new debt instrument by the Korean government itself, a guarantee which acquired credibility partly because there was a large amount of official money already behind it in the form of international lending to Korea. There was a standstill negotiated to halt the rundown of interbank claims on Brazil, but that took some time and some difficulty. I'll return to this matter shortly. Let me pause first to deal briefly with three other aspects of the architecture exercise. First, the effort to strengthen financial systems in emerging market countries. Second, the attempt to limit the size or volatility of private capital flows. And thirdly, the vexed question of appropriate exchange rate arrangements for emerging market countries. Starting with the question of strengthening financial systems, it is now widely agreed that imprudent bank lending, funded by short-term foreign currency borrowing, was a major cause of the Asian crisis and helps to explain the very high cost of that crisis. The sharp fall in Asian output that occurred in the wake of the crisis was not due primarily to restrictive monetary or fiscal policies espoused by the IMF, but rather to the virtual insolvency of the private sector, which was a reflection of the failure of international efforts to resolve the crisis. Just as the depreciation of the Mexican peso raised the fiscal cost of servicing the Tesa bonos, so the very sharp depreciation of Asian currencies wiped out the capital of banks and firms that had large foreign currency debts. In consequence, you had a situation in which insolvent creditors, or insolvent lenders, I should say, faced insolvent borrowers. Credit flows imploded, and output fell very sharply. Now, if you need equations to believe that, I direct you to Paul Krugman's website, where he has put together a very neat little piece which essentially takes the Gertler kind of model, the Bernanke-Gertler kind of model of credit flows, and internationalizes it to illustrate how this kind of crunch could occur as a consequence of the increase in the domestic currency value of foreign currency obligations. The concern with conditions of banks in emerging market countries began, however, long before the Asian crisis, or I should say a year before the Asian crisis. In 1996, the Basel Committee on Bank Supervision, working closely with counterparts from emerging market countries, began work on a statement of what became the core principles for effective banking supervision. These were issued in final form at the Bank Fund meeting in Hong Kong shortly after the onset of the Asian crisis, but before it had spread as far as it subsequently did. Thereafter, however, we saw two forms of contagion: the spread of the Asian crisis itself and the equally remarkable proliferation of codes and standards. When I last checked the IMF website, which was this morning, by the way, I counted codes in being or in draft on the supervision of banks, supervision of securities markets, and supervision of the insurance industry, on accounting standards, auditing, bankruptcy laws, and corporate governance, on data dissemination, fiscal transparency, and the transparency of monetary and fiscal policies, financial policies, and on such more arcane but important matters as cross-border insolvency and disclosure requirements for cross-border offerings and listings of securities. All of these are internationally agreed codes and standards. Now, these are good things, and most governments will presumably declare that they adhere to them. But who will assess the actual compliance with these codes and standards, and what will be done, and here it is again, where are the carrots and sticks, to encourage compliance with these codes and standards? Assessing compliance, or more realistically, progress in reaching compliance, must be left to specialists. The quality of bank supervision in a particular country can be assessed only by double-checking the work of the local bank supervisors. That means going in and examining the banks, which means in turn knowing a good deal about the bank's own debtors and credit conditions in the country. It's not something you can do in the course of a 2-week fund mission. The functioning of a country's bankruptcy regime cannot be assessed by looking at the law. One has also to look at the functioning of the bankruptcy courts and such odd matters as the fact that in some Asian countries, the foreign creditor cannot take possession of real property furnished as collateral for a loan. All of these things affect the functioning of bankruptcy regimes. As I said, these tasks cannot be piggybacked onto IMF surveillance by adding one or two staff members to a 2-week yearly mission. And I have my doubts, in any case, as to whether they should be left to the IMF if, as has been suggested, access to IMF credit should be made conditional on compliance with some of these codes and standards. You don't want to set the fund up as both judge and jury, deciding whether the country is guilty and then assessing the penalties, the further difficulty being that when under pressure the fund must lend, it's apt to relax the standards in order to do the lending. The provision of appropriate carrots and sticks will be difficult. Some, notably Secretary Summers, would leave that task largely to the private sector. In his London Business School speech, he suggested that the IMF should compile and publish assessments of compliance with key codes and standards. He didn't say the fund should do the assessments. He said it should compile the assessments made by experts. The markets would then reward compliance and punish noncompliance by refusing to lend to countries that were not up to standard. Markets, however, should and will be guided by the absolute level of compliance, insofar as they take any account of it whatsoever. For some years to come, however, it will be much more appropriate to grade countries in terms of the progress they are making toward compliance and give them incentives to sustain and accelerate that progress, not simply say pass or fail. Which says, in turn, that we need a variety of carrots and sticks, and that the task is not one appropriately left to the market, which will apply levels and not essentially rates of change in compliance. What sorts of carrots and sticks might one suggest? Here are two illustrations that have sometimes been recommended. One is that the Basel Committee of Bank Supervisors should see to it that higher capital requirements are imposed on creditor country banks which lend to banks in countries that fail to meet its standards for effective bank supervision. Now, that proposal has been around for some time. In fact, I have just read the proofs of a piece which I wrote in early 1998 and completely forgotten about, in which I made such a proposal. I don't claim credit for originality just for having thought of it in an odd moment and then forgotten it. Second, a suggestion that the IMF should punish noncompliance or slow progress by refusing access to two of its new facilities, the SRF and the CCL, which I mentioned earlier. I must confess to some uncertainty myself about another stick, requiring rapid compliance as a condition for access to ordinary IMF credit when a country faces a crisis. And the fund has done that, in effect, when it's gone into a country in crisis and said, you must, as a condition for IMF assistance, undertake certain fundamental reforms in your banking system. Now, on the one hand, when a country's in crisis is when the fund has maximum leverage, and it's going to get the country's attention. On the other hand, experience does suggest that demanding long-run structural reforms in the midst of a crisis can have the unintended effect of fragmenting domestic political support for the program and therefore preventing the government from taking ownership of the IMF program, which most people agree is absolutely essential if the program is going to be carried through. I wish that I could stand here and simply list for you a long list of incentives. The fact that the international community has not come up with them is itself a measure of the difficulty of doing so. And what I'm commenting on is the state of affairs, not the negligence of the official community, by no means. They understand the problem, but they have been at a loss to find ways of dealing with it. Let me turn next to the question of capital flows. Until the onset of the recent crisis, the so-called Washington Consensus favored the rapid liberalization of international capital flows, especially into emerging market countries. We have now come to realize that liberalization without attention to the strength of the domestic financial sector is a recipe for disaster. And that realization, in turn, has led to a rather remarkable change in official thinking about the desirability of using, or acceptability of using, taxes or outright controls to limit capital inflows into emerging market countries, especially short-term inflows into the banking sector. And recent G7 statements have given guarded endorsement to measures like those which Chile has used to discourage the short-term borrowing by banks that contributed to and then amplified the Asian crisis. It should nevertheless be noted that the G7 have yet to suggest explicitly that countries which do not presently have such controls should now adopt them. It doesn't propose any backsliding from liberalization. It merely says those who have them can keep them. I would go further. Not only by imposing punitive capital requirements on interbank lending to countries with weak financial systems, but also insisting that countries with weak banking systems and weak supervision, countries that grade badly on the core standards for banking supervision, be required to impose outright limits on their banks' foreign currency obligations, direct selective limitations on their foreign currency exposure. Inevitably, this brings us to the question of capital outflows and controls on capital outflows, which is a much more controversial subject. I have begun to wonder whether Malaysia was right after all to interrupt capital outflows. The early fears that Malaysia would use those controls to postpone necessary financial reforms has, I believe, been proven unfounded. Malaysia has actually gone further than some others in reforming its banking sector. Furthermore, Malaysia's recent economic recovery has not been distinctly inferior to that of its own near neighbors, and it began from a base far less severely depressed. It did not suffer as sharp a fall in output as some of its neighbors during the crisis itself. Finally, foreign investors do not appear to be punishing Malaysia for its lapse from orthodoxy. In other words, its credit standing has not been that seriously impaired. This, then, is a matter that deserves serious and objective and careful study of the Malaysian case. More than it will probably get from those of my colleagues who know in their hearts that capital controls don't work and are at the same time very costly. How they can hold both of those views at the same time, I don't know, but they do. In the matter of exchange rate policy, time will not permit me to speak at length on this issue, though it is one of the more interesting issues and one that's going to receive a lot more attention. The Ecuadorian proposal for dollarization is only one of a number of such proposals that's been floating around. Let me merely draw attention to the current official consensus and quote the particular formulation that Larry Summers used here in London, because it does offer me a couple of things to attack. Mr. Summers said, countries maintaining a fixed exchange rate should be expected to make explicit the extent to which monetary policy is to be subordinated to the exchange rate objective. Translation, you can't have monetary independence and a fixed exchange rate at the same time. You've got to get your priorities right. And those using fixed exchange rates as a tool of disinflation should be expected to disclose their exit strategy. The presumption needs to be that countries that are involved with the world capital market should increasingly avoid the middle ground of pegged exchange rates with discretionary monetary policies in favor of either more firmly institutionalized fixed rate regimes or floating. That phrase, firmly institutionalized fixed rate regimes, is a code word for currency boards or the adoption of some other country's currency, such as the dollar, the euro, and so forth. I tend to agree, this is not only the official consensus, it is very much the academic consensus today. It is, incidentally, one of the arguments which drove the case for EMU back in the early 90s, that fixed but adjustable exchange rates were an oxymoron. If they were adjustable, they wouldn't remain fixed. And if you wanted exchange rate stability, you therefore had to move all the way to monetary union, or you had essentially to abandon the old EMS in favor of floating, something that half happened in 1993. I do have some trouble, however, with a couple of passages in that text and in the current official view, including Larry's suggestion that countries which peg for purposes of disinflation should disclose their exit strategies. I submit that pegging an exchange rate for the purpose of changing people's expectations about the path of inflation cannot possibly have its full effect unless people think that the exchange rate peg is going to last. You can't have an effect on credibility. You can't make a change in expectations unless the change in regime is thought to be long-lasting. Nevertheless, Larry is right in believing that the use of an exchange rate peg for this purpose in a high-inflation country should be temporary unless the arrangement is then succeeded by a currency board arrangement. At the risk of seeming to suggest that governments should be deliberately deceitful, I would reformulate the matter this way. Countries that use fixed exchange rates for purposes of disinflation should have exit strategies, but would be absolutely foolish to disclose them. In my own view, moreover, the choice between the two viable extremes, an institutionalized peg or currency board, or a more or less free floating rate, should be based on a careful cost-benefit calculation. Those of you who know my work in the past will recognize that I'm referring to optimum currency area considerations. The debate over dollarization in Latin America is, I believe, being too heavily influenced by a simplistic and tactical concern, which comes down to the proposition, if I don't have an exchange rate, you can't attack it. So let's abandon the exchange rate and take on somebody else's currency. The difficulty, of course, is that what you're doing when you do that is to take on somebody else's exchange rate. If Argentina were to dollarize, it would float against the euro, the yen, and so forth. And the question, and most importantly in the case of Argentina, against Brazil. It would seem to me that one really has to ask, what are the long-run effects of adopting somebody else's exchange rate? Do I want my economy tied tightly to the dollar and to Mr. Greenspan, to the euro or to the yen? Or does the diversification of my trade dictate the sort of middle course that I can best pursue by floating? I have heard very little discussion of these longer run issues in the current debate about dollarization in Latin America. And I'm particularly appalled by the Ecuadorian debate, which proposes to rescue a country from crisis by dollarizing, which is not credible because anyone with a local currency claim on a domestic bank who is told that that claim has now been redenominated in dollars will promptly line up at the bank and say, yes, but give me real dollars. I want a claim on Citibank in New York, not the local bank in Ecuador. And if the banking system is in trouble now, I assure you it will be in greater trouble if they go that route. And while we mull over these intellectual issues, let us keep track of what countries are actually doing, because this is what really worries me. I see in East Asia a tendency for governments which floated under duress during the crisis to edge back toward de facto pegging. The Korean won, for example, has been too steady for too long in the face of very large capital inflows, which should have caused it to appreciate sharply. The government explains that it wants to accumulate $100 billion of reserves. It's already got about 70. And it is therefore intervening to hold down the won and accumulate reserves. But why should it want $100 billion of reserves unless it intends to peg the won more or less firmly in the indefinite future? I don't see the case for this reserve accumulation unless the intention is to go on doing what you're doing now, which is to keep the exchange rate more or less pegged. And that we saw in the late 90s was not a viable strategy. To finish up, let me say a bit more about the issue with which I began, how to involve the private sector in crisis resolution. The view expressed in the 1996 Ray Report has been reaffirmed repeatedly in reports and declarations from the official community. Whenever debt problems are contributing substantially to a country's difficulties, holders of the country's debt should and will be called upon to help resolve those difficulties. But those who subscribe to this general proposition do not necessarily agree on the rationale for it, or, in consequence, the appropriate form of private sector involvement. There are those who are obsessed by concern about moral hazard and therefore conclude that private creditors must be made to take losses so that they will act more prudently next time instead of helping a country to borrow too much by, in turn, lending too much. There are others who doubt the ability and political will of the official community to go on providing large-scale financing time after time, and they are chiefly concerned, therefore, to substitute private sector financing for large-scale official financing, or to use the two in tandem, and they would be quite happy if that could be done without imposing large losses on private investors. Interestingly, by the way, the Ray Report itself referred repeatedly to debt restructuring, but never used the term debt reduction. And recent official pronouncements have moved far in the direction of favoring voluntary market-based strategies for debt restructuring, perhaps too far in that direction because those strategies can take a long time to implement. More painful remedies may also be required in what Larry Summers described as the rare cases, namely those of countries which are clearly insolvent. Let me carry that a step further by employing the useful, though rough, distinction between solvency problems and liquidity problems to put the current official view this way. Some countries have worked their way into solvency problems, see Ecuador and a half dozen others. They have assumed more debt than they can be expected to service under current and foreseeable circumstances. In such cases, official financing can do very little good, and debt reduction offers the only long-lasting solution. It took us, of course, almost a decade to understand that in the case of Latin America and the debt crisis. Other countries have worked their way into liquidity problems, and more of them are likely to do that in the future. Here, of course, the first line of defense is crisis prevention. No government should do what Mexico did, accumulate a huge short-term foreign currency debt in order to prop up its currency. But how do you stop it from doing it? No government should do what Thailand did, allow its banks to accumulate huge debts to foreign banks in order to finance domestic lending. I've already noticed, however, that the official community has failed thus far to find ways of penalizing governments that make these mistakes. What, then, can be done by way of crisis resolution? Clearly, a temporary suspension of debt payments is needed when foreign creditors are unwilling to roll over short-term claims on the government or the private sector, or when interest and amortization payments on long-term debt are large relative to current earnings and reserves. In other words, a suspension is not in order unless it can make a material contribution to the alleviation of a crisis. Absent that, it's not worth the effort, and does damage, of course, to the country's creditworthiness. It should, in my view, be accompanied, in any case, with substantial front-loaded IMF assistance. We are talking about burden-sharing. We are not talking about burden-shedding. And there's a risk of going in that direction. But I tend to disagree with the G7, whose communique at the 1999 IMF meetings suggested that liquidity crises can normally be resolved by a combination of official financing and, as I said before, market-based voluntary solutions. I don't think that we can count on reaching those market-based solutions rapidly enough to forestall a sharp rundown of private sector claims and therefore a possible exchange rate crisis. At the very least, the country may need at its disposal the credible threat of a coercive solution to hasten agreement on a voluntary approach, if you wish, the counterpart of the unspoken threat on Christmas Eve when Mr. Rubin called the banks. This, of course, brings us to the hard part. Who should decide when to impose a coercive solution and how should it be implemented? Some would go so far as to say that the IMF should be given the power to impose or activate a suspension or on sovereign or private sector debt payments. But I doubt that governments would ever agree to hand that power to an international institution, and I'm not sure they should, because it is, after all, the country's own creditworthiness which is at issue when it interferes with its debt payments, and that is a decision which the government itself must make. Let's, however, be candid about this. The fund could still exercise that power policy on that power on a what I'll call a covert ad hoc basis by requiring the government to suspend its payments as a condition for receiving IMF assistance. If and when, however, it does that, it should do it forthrightly, not obliquely, as it appears to have done in the case of Ecuador, where it refused to provide enough financing for Ecuador to make its debt payments, but then declined to take responsibility for the logical and inevitable outcome, a suspension of those debt payments. If the fund is going to take that line, I think it has to declare itself an actor in the process and share responsibility for the outcome. As I said, though, it is the responsibility of governments to decide whether they should jeopardize their creditworthiness and that of their private sector by imposing a coercive debt suspension rather than seeking a market-based voluntary solution to the problem. The role of the official community in all that must be to provide it with adequate time to make the choice by providing front-loaded financing sufficient to tide the country over while it seeks to reach a voluntary solution. The problem is particularly difficult where, as in the Asian case, the suspension of private sector payments is at issue. A sovereign can, by simply the stroke of a pen, interrupt its own debt payments. As I said before, it is much harder without capital controls in place to impose or induce a suspension of private sector payments. A suggestion by Willem Bouter and Anne Seibert would go some way to solving the problem. Inclusion in all debt contracts of something they call a universal debt rollover provision. The acronym is UDROP. This would permit a debtor, once and only once, to require that its creditors roll over their claims for a stated limited period of time. It's a time-buying device designed, aimed at reaching a more longer-lasting cooperative solution. The risk of the activation of this clause would, of course, be priced into the original debt contract. Countries that had them would presumably have to pay a higher interest rate to borrow because of the risk that the clause would be invoked. But Bouter and Seibert would leave activation to the individual debtor. It seems to me that there's a case for going a bit further, that the clause contain an additional option under which the government of the country concerned would adopt legislation permitting it to activate simultaneously the rollover clauses in all such private contracts. In other words, the coordination of the individual contracts as an act of state. Otherwise, I have great difficulty seeing how one can get prompt action on the private sector side in the case of private sector debt in time, essentially, to get a longer-lasting solution in place. I don't see that you can count on the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States to call the banks every Christmas Eve when problems of this kind arise. Let me conclude by ending where I began. I think you can tell from what I've said that I fully believe that much valuable work has been done in the course of the architecture exercise. But much remains to be done. To foster the implementation of basic financial reforms required for countries to cope with volatile capital flows, to provide them and the international system with time to make sensible choices and involve the private sector in crisis resolution. I have to tell you, however, that I am pessimistic about the likelihood of further progress in either of these two directions. We have begun to forget the last crisis. 1997 is a long time ago, and we are not yet ready to think about the next one.
Professor Kennan has said that he's happy to take questions. Yes. There's no microphone, so you'll have to shout.
Speaking about Brazil, prior to the devaluation of Brazilian currency, the Brazilian government provided a plenty of foreign exchange cash for the private sector. Would you please say that this cash was partially responsible for the minor recession Brazil had last year? And would we also say that Brazil made a trade-off between short minor recession in the short term and a slow growth?
Let me divide your question, which has two parts, into three parts, one of which you didn't ask. And that was whether such a provision may have actually worsened the situation in another way. It is one of a family of measures that countries have taken, essentially to bail out their own banks from the consequences of imprudent decisions. Thailand did almost the same thing, but did it in a different way. The central bank essentially supported the forward foreign exchange rate, making it relatively inexpensive for Thai banks to cover their forward positions, but with the result that the covered interest arbitrage incentive opened wide up and capital flowed out through other routes. One of the things I did not mention, and this is why I take your question as an opportunity to mention it, is that one of the things the architecture exercise has emphasized, and I think rightly so, is ring-fencing the guarantees which countries give to their own financial systems, blanket deposit insurance, whatever it may be, in order both that foreign investors and the banks themselves may know what their exposure is and can't implicitly count on the government to bail them out when they make mistakes. We made those mistakes in the case of the savings and loan crisis in the United States, and many of the developing countries have extended tacit guarantees to their banks. This was an ex-post guarantee, but it had the same sort of effect. Now, to the actual substance of your question, I frankly can't see how the provision of the forward cover to the Brazilian banks could have provoked the recession. You may have some mechanism in mind that I don't see, nor do I see how it would have made a real difference for the path of the recession, a sharp contraction versus a shallower but longer lasting one. But to the extent that it was protected by the government, I should have think that that would have reduced the risk or likelihood of bank insolvencies and therefore prevented the kind of contraction in bank lending that overwhelmed the Asian economy. So if anything, it may have had the effect, the best I can say is it may have had the effect of mitigating the recession rather than making it worse. Okay, then we agree. Yeah. As for the path of the recession, I really don't know enough about the Brazilian situation to know what the trade-offs were. I'll have to ask my former student, who happens to be the central bank governor. Marcus.
I would support your view that there's a need for coercion to induce change in the world financial system. For example, a threat of standstill, people won't get their money out, may encourage people to use debt contracts. So that may help the way the world to begin to work. But you seem to draw back when it came to the question of devices to enable standstill to take place. Surely there should be a case for either creating a bankruptcy board, global bankruptcy board, along the lines that suggested, or strengthening the IMF in this capacity. When it came to the point, you appealed to
Well, Marcus, you've touched on a number of issues there, but let me try to answer you. Yes, you have caught me in, if not a contradiction, at least a conundrum. On the one hand, I said that governments engage in what I call strategic denial. They're reluctant to act, and they tend to refuse to recognize problems. How can they be counted then on, let me put the paraphrase part of your point this way, how can we count on them to invoke this clause early on, knowing that it's going to be costly in terms of future creditworthiness and so forth, even if it's built into the system, even if everyone knows it's there, it'd still be costly if you invoke it, when in fact they are generally reluctant to recognize crisis. Why shouldn't we give that power to the fund? Well, apart from the practical problem that governments are not prepared to give that power to the fund, precisely because they don't want the fund deciding when such things should happen. And the fund is more and the fund doesn't have to bear the consequences. I think that's the major issue. The fund is not accountable in the same sense that a government is accountable to its own citizens for actions that it takes. There is a problem here, and I readily recognize that a government, even a government that had this instrument in its toolkit, might be reluctant to use it, and much time would elapse before it was invoked. As far as it being very radical, first of all, it's a provision that would be enacted under national law in those countries that chose to go this route. It would then be binding in respect of all contracts which were negotiated under that country's law. It would not be an international provision. I didn't suggest that coercion be applied in that sense. It couldn't be done uniformly, and it would obviously be upheld only in the courts of that country. So it isn't quite as radical as that. And this brings me to the international bankruptcy idea. Even if it were politically possible to design such a code and establish such a court, or to contemplate that, it would be extraordinarily difficult to get agreement on what constituted bankruptcy of a sovereign state. U.S. and European bankruptcy laws differ enormously in the degree to which they tilt either in favor of the debtor or the creditor. I cannot count on fingers and toes combined the number of times that the German officials would insert references to moral hazard in every document that went through one of the committees I was involved in the architecture exercise. We traded it off. I removed our references to exchange rate flexibility in return for removing their references to moral hazard. I think one of the practical problems is that there are just such different notions about what constitutes bankruptcy. To try and enshrine that in a treaty and enforce it in an international court would be almost impossible. When Jeff Sachs wrote that paper, which he gave at Princeton in his Graham lecture but never published, I urged him to use the notion of bankruptcy as a metaphor, not literally, and to suggest that certain characteristics of bankruptcy law would have to be built in. Well, indeed, we have built in some of those characteristics. For example, debtor-in-possession lending under U.S. law, which is an arrangement under which the court can approve additional borrowing by the debtor after the debtor has gone bankrupt to keep the debtor in business rather than forcing the liquidation of the firm. Provide working capital, in other words. Very important. A provision, and that debt is then senior to all other debt. It's repaid in full. The whole notion of lending into arrears is analogous to that, and so forth. So there are whole the collective action clauses are similar to the provisions in effect to some of the provisions in bankruptcy law for a cram down of a settlement. And I urged Jeff to push those analogies rather than the literal idea of a bankruptcy law code internationally for sovereign states. And I think the subsequent development of the Asian crisis suggests that such a code would have been terribly difficult, would have been virtually irrelevant in that case, because it was the private sector and not the state that was the insolvent party. So rather than trying to, I've been through this game, rather than trying to get international agreement or anything quite that grandiose, or I shouldn't say that grandiose, but that complex and daunting, it would seem to me that a series of piecemeal reforms that replicated some of the features, while avoiding some of the others that are too controversial, is the best that we can expect. But you do have me dead to rights on the contradiction between governments being reluctant to face reality and the notion that they would invoke such a clause as the one I have just proposed.
Peter, could I ask two quick questions myself?
First of all, you said a couple of times that the IMF should not be the institution that should assess the regulatory progress of the various countries. If not the IMF, who? And the second question is, I was rather surprised to see, to hear no reference whatsoever to the Financial Stability Forum. Was this intentional?
All right. Who should do the assessment if not the IMF? Well, the Canadians came up with a proposal at one point in the architecture exercise, and incidentally, some of the things that didn't get implemented are intellectually more interesting than some of the things that did get implemented. The Canadians came up with an idea which rather appealed to me, which was that essentially a collegium of bank supervisors should be established, drawing on individual supervisors from various countries, forming a rotating panel, essentially, of people, that these in turn would make infrequent, periodic but infrequent and very thorough assessments of individual countries' banking supervision. You'd send out a team that would spend 6 months, perhaps, in a country and do a fairly thorough assessment, perhaps at 3 to 5 year intervals. You'd be trading frequency for thoroughness. But you'd also get expertise from neighboring countries. You'd get people who knew the situation in the country, and you could use a different panel for each such country. The Canadians had proposed this on a voluntary basis. That is to say, governments that wanted a seal of good approval could ask this collegium to do an assessment of their banks. But I could see the same thing being done on a mandatory basis, instead of what I would call a second-hand assessment by one member of an IMF team in the course of a 2-week visit to the country, a thorough assessment at infrequent intervals, backed up perhaps by supplementary visits to see what progress is being made. But it does seem to me that one has to rely on the professionals in the supervisory regime, in the bankruptcy regime, in the various areas, rather than creating a huge international bureaucracy, standing bureaucracy sufficient to do the job, or relying on a sort of semi-amateur assessment by macroeconomists at the fund, and some of whom are my former students also. On your second question, whatever happened to the Financial Stability Forum? The Financial Stability Forum, for those of you who are not familiar, this is another institution created the only real institution that's been created in the course of this process. Created in the course of the architecture process at the suggestion of Tietmeyer in Germany, which was to be a standing body that would consider various aspects of the financial system on an ongoing basis and propose reforms as the need arose. And it took on, as I recall, three major issues that it would consider in the first round. It consists primarily of central bankers and from the G10 countries, but also from developing countries, as I understand it now. The three issues it chose to take on were the activities of offshore banking centers, to the extent to which any agreement among the major industrial countries could be circumvented by taking your bank to the Seychelles or some such place and conducting your imprudent lending from there. The second was the question of limiting the volatility of international capital movements. And the third was whether hedge funds and other such entities should be more closely regulated. To the best of my knowledge, the group has not made very much progress with any one of these issues, though I understand there's more agreement among the developed countries that they should go after the offshore centers, but they've always felt that way. Not universally, but most. I've put it this way, I think it's more than a talking shop, but less successful thus far than one might have hoped it would be. One other institution, by the way, has come out of this whole thing, and it's quite interesting, and that is a permanent or standing body known as the Group of 20. We have G this, G that, and G whiz. And the 20 is the first such body that includes on a regular and senior basis, finance ministry basis, not central bank, representatives of the major industrial countries and the major key developing countries. For further discussion of these issues. Now, that thus far is a talking shop. If the Canadian finance minister, Mr. Martin, has his way, it'll become more than that. He's the chairman. Where that'll go, I don't know. But it's the first time that formal recognition has been given to the proposition that this is a, a two-part story with the developing countries, the emerging market countries, and the developed countries in the same boat, as it were.
Well, Marcus, one more question. Final question.
Any shift in Larry's thinking is ex officio a significant development, but that's. First of all, as far as Larry's interpretation of the crisis is concerned, I reread that speech this morning because I figured there'd be some question about it. What he said was that it was a two-part crisis. It was essentially triggered by macroeconomic defects and structural defects in the financial system. It turned into a creditor run. I've heard him say informally at the Treasury that it's a combination of the Krugman crisis model and the Big Diamond run model, one following the other. And it's an interesting question whether the financial crisis precedes the currency crisis or vice versa. There's a lot of work on that, as you know. So I don't think he's changed his view much on that. And certainly in the Mexican case, that was the view. I mean, he told me once that Dvig Diamond was cited in Treasury discussions about five times a day during the height of the Mexican crisis at the senior level. On his views on the role of the fund, yes, he is in some sense approaching Stan Fisher. He and Stan are converging, which is not surprising. They tend to think a lot alike on a lot of issues. But in the sense that the fund should be fairly open-handed I hate to use the word lender of last resort because it carries a lot of baggage with it. I didn't mean to say garbage. I meant to say baggage. But the notion that the fund should concentrate its lending on fewer countries and be more open-handed in that lending to countries in crisis, that has been, I think, a part of Larry's thinking for some time. In fact, Larry and other people at Treasury were critical of the Council on Foreign Relations report on this same subject, which I signed. Partly because the council people would have put, our council report would have put essentially excessively tight constraints on the fund, and by implication the United States, in making large-scale assistance available to those countries which in the joint judgment of the Treasury and the fund, needed it. Larry, however, views are different from those which Fisher expressed in his 1998 ASSA speech, in that Larry would institutionalize this essentially by working entirely through the Supplementary Reserve Facility and the Contingent Credit Line. Now, he's had no customers for the Contingent Credit Line thus far, and obviously has to be made more attractive if it's going to be made useful. Whereas Stan was talking about an undifferentiated lender of last resort function rather than a specialized one within the institution. Now, these are organizational differences, and the packaging is secondary. But I think you see what if you read between the lines, and maybe I'm reading too much into this, but if you read between the lines in that speech, what he is saying to critics on the Hill and some of their friends like Meltzer, is we want a smaller fund, that is one that will lend less to most countries, but will have the capacity to lend hugely when we see a major crisis on our hands. And we therefore minimize the number of times that we create moral hazard, though when we do it big.
Peter, thank you very much. Before I finally wrap up, may I take the opportunity of inviting everyone here to reception in the senior common room at the end, once we have left. Peter, they were splendidly clear and comprehensive, and indeed radical in many ways. I was particularly interested in hearing the defense of the Malaysia. We must talk about that afterwards. But I think we'd better talk about it at the reception. So, Peter, thank you very, very much for a splendid